Okay, right, where do we go from here? Are we talking about Hong Kong?
This is a mess.
this is why we, yeah.
Okay, so what we should go from, Will saying, can I bring up another example?
Over the past 12 years, countries around the world have turned away from democratic values more than towards them, reports Freedom House, a democracy watchdog. This trend in 2017 was so severe that the think tank branded democracy as in crisis. David Runciman, formerly head of politics at Cambridge University, has written that almost from nowhere, the question is upon us. Is this how democracy ends? Today we're going to be discussing democracy, whether it is struggling, whether it is normal, whether it is functioning around the world, or whether it is on the road to destruction and ready to be dead and buried. With me today are Will, Peter and Max. I'm your host, Theo. And gentlemen, who wants to come in on this? Who wants their opinion of democracy and its progress over the next few years to be open first?
I think democracy will be completely fine and it's just a temporary blip at the moment, which will easily, you know, settle out and everyone will be pro-democracy again in 20 years, 10 years, probably less.
Max, your optimism cheers us all on.
Always optimistic me.
Peter?
I agree with Max, but in a less optimistic way. 30 countries, which I would say are core democracies. These are 30 countries which will not change and will always stay as core democracies. And as long as they stay as core democracies, then democracy isn't really in too much threat or under too much pressure.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So democracy may change and fluctuate over time, but in the end it will reach an equilibrium again.
Yeah, they will. I think democracy's been around such a relatively short amount of time.
So modern democracy has probably been around since roughly the Enlightenment, when people rebelled against the notion of kings and monarchy. The first democracy, the American Republic, I think is a broadly accepted one.
Mm-hmm, I'd agree with that.
And then the French Republic was established several years later-ish, sort of. We can come back to that, can't we, Max? So it's about 300 years, 250 years, the idea of it and the actual implementation. So, but then, yeah, you have democracy in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and democracy being sort of the idea of voting and everyone having a say.
My point is, so you've had democracy for 250 years, and even those weren't fully emancipated democracies. Democracies where everyone could vote, provided you were old enough, have been around, 100 years, I think? Was it New Zealand was the first countrywide entity?
Over 100 years.
Was that 1897?
Mm-hmm.
I think where women were first given the vote. And so I'd say that's when democracy truly started, when you had countries which the entire citizenry could vote. And so for all of human history, 100 years is a fraction of a percent that we've had a way of governing. For almost all of it, we've just had a strong man led a tribe or a king led a kingdom. And we're still in an adjustment period of true democracy.
Ooh.
And there will be some fluctuations.
Okay, all right.
We're gonna
come back to that. We've got a lot of time to explore that deeper, mm-hmm. Peter. All right, but Will hasn't said anything. And it's only fair that we hear his dulcet tones as well.
Absolutely. Well, my dulcet tones are then saying that I am ultimately pessimistic. I do not believe that democracy necessarily has a place in the future that we sort of all expect it to. We think, oh, these democratic institutions that are here, they will be here forever. But I don't think that's the case. I feel like as we, particularly with things like the rise of China and the rise of India, we're seeing more and more powerful nations which aren't as strong. Well, China isn't a democracy, and India currently is going regressing a little bit in the democratic sphere. And particularly when these sort of powerhouses really come to the global forefront, what happens when, once again, instead of we just have an ultimately powerful US and no one to contest them, where this the US is this powerful democracy spreading freedom across the world, as they'd like to say. Mm-hmm. What happens when that is once again counterbalanced by an autocratic regime which has equal power? I'm not convinced that democracy, there is something innate in democracy which means it just doesn't go away. I think it's the best system for the people living under it. It's the best for them. But in terms of success that a country can have, it might not be the optimal system which would then possibly lead to countries moving towards other systems that would enable them to govern in a way they see is more effective for the nation,
okay.
which would sort of trend towards authoritarian.
So you're saying don't take democracy for granted.
Yeah.
It has merits, but with the rise of China and India especially, and you talked about America's failings as a country, it's beginning to backslide.
Yeah.
Okay, well, America's quite an interesting example, and I think it's fair that we touch on America first. The oldest explicitly democratic country, and the Republic established in the late 1700s, George Washington as president, etc., etc. I think none of us would dispute the idea that American democracy is suffering a pretty rough ride under President Trump. Do we think that that is a harbinger of democracy? Do we think that democracy worldwide is going to suffer an irreversible decline because of Trump's actions?
No, I think that the election of Trump is a consequence of a slight decline as opposed to his election causing a decline. So what happened is, in the 2016 election, lots of people just didn't care enough to vote. I think especially something I also think of Brexit is because Trump's presidency has been so divisive and Brexit is so divisive, the next elections, the next set of elections, is going to have there's going to be a lot more people getting involved because they see what happens when people don't get involved, which means that democracy will actually, you know, at a sort of, including everyone in the population, I think democracy will improve and strengthen as a result of these few turbulent years.
Okay, that's quite interesting.
Whereas I would look at the US and think the problem is a lot more systemic than... Trump is merely a symptom. Trump, I don't think, is the cause of the democratic woes of the current America. If we look at, a lot of what America has the problem with is that money is very, very central to their democratic institutions. For example, the Citizens United Supreme Court case, which essentially allowed corporations to donate as if they were people to candidates, which this happened in 2010, and this was by no means the first, but one of the most famous cases, where it essentially allows a corporation to have a large amount of influence over the elective process by buying adverts, supporting certain candidates, that kind of thing. And it's things like that that might not explicitly say, okay, well, this is getting more authoritarian, because it's not like there's a strong man leading it. But it means less of the decision-making is coming from the people and more of it is coming from corporations, which are owned by a smaller number of people and often from elsewhere in the world, not necessarily American companies.
David Koch died recently, and he's two brothers, Dave, I forget what the Koch brothers, basically, and they were Republican mega donors, industrial billionaires, and they had a big influence in shifting Republicans to a more libertarian, right-leaning position. And they are seen by many people, and in my opinion quite rightly, as having a negative impact on America's political sphere.
You're right. Like, America has so many things inherent in their democracy which make it flawed. Like, gerrymandering is so prevalent in America. The whole
where they move.
Where you can draw the borders of where people vote, essentially. So you can get everyone who votes for one party to be in the same place, so they'll get less votes. Well, what do you know what state it was where...
North Carolina, wasn't
was
it?
Was it North Carolina where they had, I think Democrats got almost 50% of the vote and then got 3 out of 12 candidates or something? It's possible to get almost none of the actual representation despite having the majority of votes in America. It's a flawed system. You also have things like partisan judges and just the fact that billions of dollars are spent on races on statewide races, on national races. However, I am optimistic. I think Donald Trump will start to cure America because of the anti-Donald Trump reactionary movement that's happening, because always there's a problem with the Democrats. Democrats are seen as apathetic. It's the same as lots of left-of-centre parties and left-wing parties around the world. So, Labour does worse when it's raining during an election because Labour voters are less likely to vote in the rain. They're less committed to vote. But now I would say that the anti-Donald Trump movement has led to a reason, it's given gumption, it's pushed people into action, and it's making people want to vote and want to engage in politics for the first time, or want to engage in politics more than they ever have, which will hopefully push for more reforms, will lead to a reactionary movement which will strengthen American democracy in the short to medium term.
But the thing is with Donald Trump is, okay, right, 2020, I don't know, Warren gets in, right? There was a big push for anti-Donald Trump voters. We've got Warren in. Do you think that the... I mean, I'm not convinced that the voter vitriol that's been stirred up against Trump will last. And what happens when you no longer have a solid single point where you can aim all that against? What happens when instead you're having to aim that against these complex institutions that have centuries of legal precedent and need some very complicated decisions to be made to make small, subtle changes that don't have the big impact of Orange Man bad?
I think, actually, you're assuming that Trump will labour under the phrase, go quietly. So he loses the election, hopefully, and that's it. He just retires, like John Major, he retires from the public sphere and comes out at key moments to give a wise and informed opinion on complex matters. He's not going to go quietly. He'll be around till he dies, tweeting and whipping up people. He'd probably run for president again in 2024 if the Republican Party lets him. It's entirely conceivable. And so I think Orange Man Bad will still be quite a rallying figure and quite a horribly divisive figure on the American political landscape, even when/if he leaves in 2020.
Yeah, so I think America's future, hopefully, this is also like an aspirational thing, because I really want American democracy to be strengthened, because I am scared that if democracy goes in America, then it will go basically everywhere else in the world. Because I disagree with the whole idea of Team America, world police or whatever, you know, the sole defender of democracy, but they are a figurehead essentially, or like a global it's a global beacon of, look, the richest country in the world, it is democratic, we should be a democracy because the best country is, and I don't want that to change.
I mean, in some ways, hasn't Trump strengthened other democratic institutions, which have, the EU has arguably become more unified and more purposeful in the wake of Trump being president, because it's the sole challenger big enough to stand up to Trump and lead on its own. And in the same way, it's now developing a defence ministry, and it's von der Leyen, the new president, has developed executive vice presidents, a new role, three each, which have a key responsibility in terms of trade and international affairs, which is designed to give the EU more clout overseas, whereas before it's just relied on America. Now it's realising it's going to have to stand up for itself a bit more, which I think is a positive.
I think democracy is also a side effect of the average person's circumstances improving, because as someone no longer has to worry about, so let's say at the moment we in England, very easy lives, okay, what we do, go to work, like, I don't know how long do people work, 9 to 5, you know, 5 days a week. What do we do in the rest of the time? Not a lot. We can chill, work, let's be honest, it's not that hard on the grand scheme of things. You're not working, toiling away on the fields for 12 hours a day every day. So with that spare time comes spare time for you to think about other things, such as the political process in your country and how you want to improve it or you want to change things. So as like developing countries, as they do develop and get better, people will get more interested in being in their own political system and being involved in it more. And by extension, that will always lead to more democracy. So just because that is a slow period, that's a very slow process, it will definitely come and it will definitely be good for democracy on a global scale.
But I mean, haven't they found, to some extent you might be right, but haven't they also found that the average person only thinks about politics for 4 minutes a week? Which isn't very long.
That is true, but even if it is only for 4 minutes, that's better than for 1 minute.
Yes, it's 4 times 1 minute. There was an interesting, because a lot of people seem to say that, oh, we're turning into 1984, you know, things are being controlled and clamped down upon. But I saw an interesting comparison where it's not actually like 1984. There was a contemporary author to Orwell who wrote a book that I can't remember the name of, so obviously very well
Brave
researched.
New World. Adolphus Huxley's Brave New World?
Might have been, but it was one where they were controlled not by being ordered to do things, but they were merely distracted by pleasurable activities.
Brave New World.
Brave New World, that's it. Okay. So, and it was things like this where if you create, because the modern world, you can access so much information at your fingertips. I can, with my laptop, I can access almost any information anywhere in the world instantly. And am I changing the world with this? Am I making political, like, big strides into the future and we're doing scientific research. No, I'm browsing Reddit. Like, it's the kind of thing where you, once you overload people with enough information, particularly with the internet, where we're saying this could be the world-changing new technology, where you can give people information to decide what to do with their futures, people don't use it for that, and they never have, and I would be surprised if they ever do. So I feel like we are getting to the point where it doesn't really matter that we have more information. It doesn't matter that we might be able to talk to other people in the world. We're more educated, we have more time for leisure, because we won't necessarily use it to further democratic institutions directly or indirectly. It'll start to just be frittered away on the many addictive apps we have on our phones and memes.
That's quite a complex point. So, I mean, isn't it very common for people to just say, oh, it's a dystopia because of this one thing? I mean, do you think that because we share one feature in common with Brave New World that we're now heading in that direction?
No, but I think it's... You can look at these signs and... It's a trend that... Okay, I don't necessarily believe we're in Brave New World. I'm not making the point that that is where we are, where this is our future. But there are elements of that that ring uneasily true, shall we say. You can look at things like that and go, that's not actually too far from reality.
Okay.
And that makes me uncomfortable, because that is something that I don't think is conducive to good democracy, is if you have a population that's apathetic, not through the necessarily their own choices, but because they've been sort of shaped like that, and because the world around them is pushing them in that direction.
Okay. So you're saying that some people are so, have like so much choice, so much information, that we just give up, right?
Yeah.
Would you say that that will eventually lead to a loss of democracy around the world?
I think it could be a contributing factor. I wouldn't say this is the thing that's going to change it, but I think it certainly plays
into it. So if you look at Switzerland, or if you look at Germany or somewhere like that, they will never not be a democracy. I cannot envision a future where Germany is not a democracy. And
we've said... Right, okay.
Like,
I think...
No, what I want to say is, you have some places which are wealthy countries, which have been a democracy for a considerable amount of time and have essentially been grandfathered into the national ethos that we are a democracy, this is part of our country. I cannot see a country like that ever regressing to the point where they're not recognisably a democracy again, because I don't think anyone or many people exist out there who say, yes, I don't want to live in democracy. Everyone wants to be in a democracy, especially one you're so used to it and is giving you consistently a good standard of living, and your parents had it and your grandparents had it. No one wants to change that. So I think once a country becomes a democracy and reaches a certain threshold of having democratic institutions for long enough and being a wealthy enough country, it will stay a democracy, bar some miraculous event that ends the world.
Whereas I disagree with that, I think, because I feel like somewhere like Germany, okay, I'm 99% confident we're not getting Hitler Mark II, which is, we're not getting another authoritarian leader in Germany anytime soon. However, I don't think that necessarily means that we don't get a slide backwards into maybe a little bit more, not so much like Turkey, but going in that direction, for instance, where you have democratic institutions, but how effective they are is debatable. And I feel like if this slide is gradual enough, it can happen without the big outrage there would be if someone was like, I'm in charge now.
My criticism of that argument as a whole, if we talk back to Brave New World and talk about internet and distraction, is what you're effectively saying is you're going on the axiom that people before the internet were much more involved in politics or much more able to understand and study politics. I think that simply wasn't the case. I think it's very easy to harken back to the good old days where people were much more informed and sociable and intelligent and good-looking and fit and healthy and all this, that and the other. But I think in the same way, because of course, when we look at history, the things that stand out are the politics. What doesn't stand out is the 95% of the time that wasn't politics. It was just ordinary people going about their business. And so I think, in fact, we are not that much more apathetic around politics than people always have been. I think the internet changes the rules of the game slightly, but as people, we retain the same characteristics towards politics we always have, outside of a few weirdos like us. Broadly, and outside big events such as Brexit, broadly people aren't that bothered.
Mm. Could I add a second point to the internet thing? Because I think certainly part of the internet thing is that people are getting more apathetic, but I think in terms of my main issue and the thing that scares me about the internet isn't so much the people, it's the data gathering. When you have, we look at Cambridge Analytica, if you can, the way that they were making models of people using 500 different data points and predicting when they would be feeling a certain way, so when they would be most able or most open to political adverts. If they're hungry, they're more likely to be angry, and that's something that is a fact and can be used to manipulate people to a degree. And that scares me more than I think necessary apathy, because if we get to the point where data science is getting better, it's every day like unbelievably good, and you get new things like AI models and all this sort of stuff. Once we get to the point where the data science behind campaigns becomes more important than the policies, then we no longer really truly have a democracy in many ways, because if you can manipulate votes based on having thousands of different adverts shown to different people because that will hit that person especially more than anyone else, that's not the same as campaigning on this is what our policy is, vote for us. That you're getting into manipulation of people who won't realise it, and there isn't all that much you can do about it, and it's quite effective and will only get more effective.
Okay. It would be good to explore that point further, but for the sake of time, we're going to have to move on. Potentially that could be a blog post or further discussion in the future. We talked about America. We had a nice tangent going off into Brave New World and so on from then. I think it's time to look at a more questionable democracy. I've not thought this far ahead in terms of planning, so I'm just sort of thinking on my feet here a little bit. Let's discuss India. Okay, India, de facto a democracy. It has democratic institutions. It has technically a free press. But under Narendra Modi, the current Prime Minister of India, it is backsliding quite viciously. And I can see the panic on everyone's faces as they just look up India on their phones and laptops and try and find out as much as they can about this country of 1 billion people in about 10 seconds.
Firstly, 1.5 billion or whatever.
Ah, nice. You've got the Google searching time.
No, I have not Googled the population of India. I just know it's population.
He's just a nerd.
I'm just a nerd. How would you say it slid back?
I think Modi
I would argue is a Hindu nationalist.
One of the key elements of his actions is that he has quite effectively suppressed critical press. And so there are very few national news sources that attack him or criticise his policies. I think he whips up emotions and anger and fear of Muslims, a minority in India, in order to get votes in key states. He oppresses and enforces Hindu caste system, where people are locked into a social class based on this group of people they're born to, which is all direct contravention to what a democracy should look like. Socially mobile, socially fluid, free, open, tolerant.
But at the same time, these are essentially just campaign promises. It's one man and a couple people in a party who are shouting angrily at other people. They aren't going out of their way to say, okay, we're removing polling stations, we're making it harder for people to vote, we're cutting back on political education funding. Those things aren't happening in India. It's more the other way, I would say, because they're continuing to increase the standard of living in India. People are getting better educated, more people can read, more people can write, more people can access the internet. I feel like Indian democracy is not in as bad a shape as people say it is. I don't think Narendra Modi is as dangerous or as damaging to democracy in India as people fear.
So what this is, just campaign bluster, as we've seen on many campaign trails across the world.
People will say things in a campaign and then instantly tone back their actions. And I think Narendra Modi has toned back his actions compared to the apocalyptic warnings people were giving during his campaign of what a second Narendra Modi term would look like.
Okay. And you're kind of drawing on the idea that Max came up with earlier, and there's people have more become more educated and have more time to think on other things, they become more democratically involved and more capable.
I just found a Chinese newspaper that says that India proves democracy is no longer fit for purpose.
Ah,
well,
yes.
China's model shows the way. So my opinion on democracy has been changed. I now hate democracy. The South China Morning Post told me I should.
So going off vaguely what Peter was saying, and then what I was saying earlier, is I feel like just as the rise of democracy was a multi-generational thing, it wasn't like over 5 years in the country, they went from a, you know, dictatorship to a democracy. Everything takes time, and so must the decline of democracy. And just as we've had a few years of dubious economic democratic progress, or, you know, even decline, doesn't mean that that's going to continue. Doesn't mean that's going to, you know, the naysayers aren't going to be correct that it's going to lead to the end of democracy in the West, because that's just, it's so deeply entrenched in our sort of, you know, national sense of being that it can't go in 5 or 10 years. It's going to need a long time of, you know, some serious negative things happening, like maybe sort of a, you know, sustained recession or very slow economic growth, or people suddenly hating progress.
Well, I mean, if you look at current Western Europe and see that far-right governments are here, like, they're not something that hasn't existed yet. There are examples of this. And then every time you look at a far-right government, democracy gets weaker in that country. I mean, it's very rare that you have a far-right government who's like, yes, we're going to preserve democracy and not make any moves to subvert it in any way. And I feel like as we are getting this general shift to the right, in particularly Europe, but also elsewhere, as we've seen, and that's something that could affect us. Brexit Party, the right wing of the Tory Party, and UKIP are forces which conceivably... Well, okay, we can discount UKIP for now, at least. Conceivably could hold a significant amount of sway over our current political system, and they don't have to get too much more powerful until we have a fairly far-right-leaning government.
Sorry, I'm just debating use of the word far-right, because, yes, we will think they're far-right because we live in a very central, you know, English politics, we're pretty central, you know, maybe we're leaning a bit more to the right at the moment, but to describe some of these parties as far-right, I think is...
Okay, we're not
alarmist, I guess, so more, definitely more right-leaning, but I feel like a far-right party, you know, is... something like the Nazis. Sorry, I didn't want to bring up the Nazis, but I can't think of any other far-right party.
Okay.
How about National Rally?
There you go.
I'll rephrase that as more, explicitly nationalist, shall we say. They have far more nationalist tendencies than traditionally.
I mean, even in Britain, we're doing pretty well because we still don't have an alternative for Deutschland, which is the AfD, which is a far-right party in Germany, National Rally in France, in Spain, they have Vox, I think. Initially, you've got the Northern League, or just the League, as it's called now. So we still don't really have an equivalent to them. The Brexit Party is only a single-issue party. Although it does dog whistle on immigration and sovereignty, it's still not explicitly near that far right.
I would like to say there are three major nationalist parties in the UK. Plaid Cymru, Sinn Féin and the SNP. But you don't have to be right-wing to be a nationalist party. They're all...
No, but in the context we're talking about, it's quite obvious we're talking about right-wing nationalism.
Yeah, but I just feel like you're equating nationalism can only be a right-wing thing, and that is not necessarily true.
That's true.
I agree with you. But when you have... But this is... We're talking about areas of the UK. If we talk about the UK as a whole and we had a nationalist party doing well sort of across the UK... I mean, I suppose a lot of the problem is with the UK is... The parties in power tend to be English parties, and English nationalism is something that is at sort of the forefront of our politics.
No, you can get British nationalism. The BNP, forced to be reckoned with.
If you look at someone like the Brexit Party, they're not going woo Wales. They're very much an English party, sort of through and through, really.
Mm.
Like, that is, and because England is sort of the strongest element in our system.
Talk about the BNP, right? So we say they're our furthest right party, the BNP?
They're not really a party, though.
Yeah.
They're more or less dead.
No political presence at all.
Yeah, they lost it all at the last election.
Yeah.
They had, like, two councillors in Lancashire or something.
Yeah. So, we do have these far-right parties, but they have no power and are in no way an actual political force.
So, in many senses,
British politics is more enduring and more centrist, and I think we give it credit for.
As I'd like to say that the UK is one of the countries, I believe, which will never not be a democracy, because it's so ingrained in British culture. Democratic institutions may appear to be weakened, people may appear to become more authoritarian, but I think that is not necessarily true. And I think that Britain will always remain democratic, because we can't imagine anything where we're not, essentially.
But do you think the people who lived, I don't know, in the 1980s in the Soviet Union imagined that this could fall, or people who lived in the Roman Empire imagined it could fall? I feel like basing your entire kind of projection for the future on it can't because it's always been this way isn't a particularly sound argument. I can see Britain in 100 years being a very different kind of nation than it is now, but I don't necessarily, as with Germany, I don't think in 5 years we get another authoritarian leader.
I think looking anything past 30 years in the future is essentially pointless. With the rate of technological change, you can't say, yes, things will be different in 100 years. We have no way of knowing what they'll look like, because we have no way of knowing how humanity will live in 100 years' time if we're all just living in a Matrix-style computer simulation. You know, that's
maybe
not unreasonable to me. But we, will design one, just plug your brain in, and you'll go to work.
Or maybe that'll be the Matrix, inside the Matrix.
Oh, weird.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's like, I feel like we can't look at the future. You can't say, oh, we won't be the same in 100 years because we'll be unrecognisable due to how we'll live being unrecognisable.
Okay. Well, okay, I understand that. And yeah, I agree that looking that far in the future is kind of impossible. But when you look at Hong Kong, you have a highly advanced, highly technologically advanced and politically and socially advanced in terms of they've got skyscrapers, you have very complex financial technology going on here. I mean, these are advanced nations here. And what happens when a part of that tries to say, no, we don't want authoritarianism, we want democracy? And when you look at Hong Kong, the protests have been unprecedented. They've been going on for something like 15 weeks. There are so many people involved. They are very, very sort of powerful, and it's been a concerted effort. These would, in almost anywhere else, change so many things, but China has resisted most, if not all, of the protesters' real demands.
I mean, there were two quite important developments in the past couple of weeks. Carrie Lam, the governor appointed by China, backed down and scrapped the extradition bill, which is basically a law that they were protesting over in the first place. And then she was also caught in a recording, and not realizing the cameras on her, saying that the PLA, China's army, People's Liberation Army, would not enter Hong Kong. And no, that's quite two big steps, because we have been variously discussing, will the Chinese send the army in? Will it be Tiananmen Square? The answer seems to be no. But despite Carrie Lam conceding ground to the protesters, they still want more. So where does it end?
But that's the thing, because the bill's been scrapped and the leader of Hong Kong says the Chinese army won't come in. I feel like, imagine if we had these protests in London where almost half the population of the UK was on the streets of their cities fighting with police, shutting down airports, shutting down train stations. I mean, we would have massive change within a week. This is massive. But China cannot afford to let Hong Kong gain anything, really. And it's showing, because I don't think the Hong Kong protesters will win. I don't think they can. The number of the power on the other side and the technology on the other side, I think, just makes it impossible.
I mean, at the same time, it may slow down Chinese response in future if they try and subvert democracy in any way 5 years down the line. So this extradition bill effectively made it easier for Chinese police to have jurisdiction in Hong Kong. And so I think if they try any of that again, they know the response will be severe, and so it may give them food for thought, because the deadline is, I think it's 2030, so one country, two systems is the phrase used to describe Hong Kong's relationship with China when it left British governorship. But I think the deal Britain signed with China expires in 2030, and so that then comes up for debate, and China may try and assume Hong Kong to its as directly a part of China, but I imagine the protests may well have knocked a few heads together in Beijing.
But can these protests stop a concern? Like, if the Chinese government has its mind set on, we want Hong Kong to be part of China by 2030, or maybe 2035, want it to be as integrated as we can get it, as if it was a Chinese city. If China says this is what's going to happen, I really struggle to see a world where that doesn't happen. Maybe it gets delayed 5 years, but it still happens.
Yeah, it will happen, but it will, may well happen over a much larger timescale and have a much weaker effect. I mean, they said the extradition bit would happen. It was first shelved and now it's been dropped. So it's not all... It's powerful, but it's not all-powerful when it comes to Hong Kong.
So, Will, is your point essentially that if you get an autocratic nation, and like a dictatorship, which is sufficiently advanced and has sufficient resources, they can essentially ignore protests,
yes,
calling for democracy? And I'm assuming you think that so currently China can essentially ignore protests and ignore calls for democracy. Are you saying that over time, as technology develops, as countries get richer, more countries will be able to do this?
Yes.
And democracy will be harder and harder to manifest in those countries?
Yes. Because I think if you look at China itself, mainland China, could that be democratic without the army deciding it needed to be democratic? No. I don't think the population of that country, no matter what they do, unless they have either, I don't know, it doesn't happen unless there's something, the decision made at high levels. The people no longer have the power, as they would do, say, we look at the Arab Spring. The people had the power to take down the current regime. I mean, they didn't generally build very good democratic regimes, but they can bring down the regimes. The regimes couldn't stop them. But look at China. Could the people bring down China? I don't think so.
I think they could. I think if enough people protested, there would be a tipping point, wouldn't there? A point where the mass of the population outweighed the force of the government.
I think Will's convinced me. I don't genuinely think that there will come a point where governments can just sit with all of the technology, and because it used to be like the people control the government's survival, but I can easily see it reaches a point where the government controls the people's survival. And like when people stop getting food, they might capitulate more easily to government demands.
Yeah, the government kind of relies on the people to have that power. Like internationally, if China's like, oh, you're protesting, let's starve half our population, we're feeling that they wouldn't be making as much money as they do, and other countries would be like, wait a second, this isn't good, and then get involved. And with a weaker China, then that makes foreign intervention much more likely, especially in the
foreign
other...
Foreign intervention in China always works.
Always works.
The Chinese army is enormous and very powerful. I mean,
yeah, but the
US
army are also the people. It's something that lots of people forget is... the most populous part of the army is, you know, your standard infantry people, right? And they are people. They have families and whatever. And they won't just go along with the government for everything. There will be a tipping point which they'll be like, wait a second, I don't want this.
But the tipping point for an army is quite far down. Like, before you get the army deciding, you know what, we're defecting from our government, you have to get a long way down this road.
Well,
I
no,
don't think
it comes down to, is my loyalty to the party or to the people? Hi, Mum, how are you doing? Oh, you're starving. Well, that's fine, because it's in the glorious name of our glorious leader, Mao Zedong. No, that's not a conversation that's going to happen, partly because that's not how a Chinese person speaks, but also partly because you're not going to... But also because if you hear your mum or your son or your sister or brother is starving, I don't think that's sort of an emotional call that you can just quite easily put the phone down.
But I don't think the conversation goes like that. The conversation is, Mum, I have to stay in the army, otherwise they're going to kill you. Or the conversation...
they're going to kill every single person.
Or the conversation goes, pick up the phone, oh, this line is unavailable, all contact has been cut. Like, the government can control essentially all communications. There's no way that someone in Manchuria can talk to someone in Hanoi. What is it, Hanoi?
What, you reckon...
No, Hanoi's in Vietnam, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's the island I'm thinking of in the south?
Hainan?
Hainan. Like, there's no way that they, without if the government
chooses to stop
communications... What,
do you reckon a substantial amount of the people of China would stand for the government suspending their civil liberties?
I don't think they would know what's going on. It'd be impossible to coordinate protests... Sorry. Across a country as big as China, if the government decides to shut down all communication, like, except for government communication.
Okay.
If the only information you can get is from the government saying everything's fine, or telling you that, oh, the protests here are acts by terrorists who want to destroy Chinese way of life and kill all of Chinese people, you'll know nothing different, because you'll have to literally be word of mouth having to send the message to you.
Because okay. I agree, I think the question with somewhere like China is two-part. It's, can they overthrow the government? Which, personally, I think the answer is probably no. And would they overthrow the government? Which I also think, because of the decades of rather effective control, and when a certain party has control over essentially all media in the country, because of the way that the internet works, you can even they can control that.
I mean,
well.
That is true, because the decades of control meant that there was no popular uprising in Tiananmen Square in 1989.
Well, 1989, has there been one since? Like, imagine if in the UK soldiers shot like a few hundred people in somewhere in London. Does the rest of the country not?
I'm not saying I'm not directly saying, oh yes, this automatically proves there will be another protest. But I am saying, I think that's quite a big anomaly to overlook and say, well, the party doesn't always have it their way.
But they repress that. They stop that from getting any further, and they have done their best to erase that from the memory.
Most people
of China.
In China don't know what Tiananmen Square.
That's true, but
is
consequently, that also means they're probably less fearful of the army. I mean, does that also mean that there's conversely, there's another, it's liable that they could also protest without being worried of being shot by the army. I mean, I'm spitballing a little bit here, but they also haven't seen that they fear the army a bit less because of it.
But I feel like the lack of fear of the army only lasts until the first person gets shot, which I feel doesn't take very long to happen. And for instance, if we look at the going to the technology side of it, if we look at the you know, the new social contract stuff with China, where you say you, I don't know, jaywalk, you can then get these penalty points that sort of in your rating system for your life, which can make it more expensive to get train tickets and more difficult to get this, harder to get jobs.
I mean, in one sense, not an unreasonable system, because if you behave well, you get cheaper stuff. Like, that's a pretty good principle for...
Yeah,
like,
it is a great system.
No,
it's just...
Who's
implementing it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry,
you
the
know,
system...
I'm not saying it's good because the Chinese government are implementing it. I'm saying it's good despite the Chinese government.
You need an all-moral supercomputer to set it up.
Because
no one interferes.
Social credit points if you talk bad about the government online.
Well, yeah, we're not saying
take
that.
Away
be,
those bits.
Yeah, we're saying, you know, if you rob a shop, you should have higher prices at said shop or set change shops
in future. If you rob a shop.
But it's also the thing of, okay, you mentioned something against the government, now you can't travel by train, you're stuck in your town.
Yeah, we're not saying that bit's good. I feel like we're universal in our condemnation of not being able to speak out against the government.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where this is so pervasive, and once this gets control of every little bit of your life, it's so easy just to manipulate people into just being certain ways, or you have so much control. You can stop people before they even start thinking about rebelling because, oh no, it's now more expensive to travel by train. They can't get to work. They're less likely to get a job. You can destroy people's lives in a way that they, before they even start getting... Before they even really can start thinking about... changing to do other things, or think like the act of almost thinking about starting to rebel against the government is almost enough to start you on this path of where your life gets actively worse.
I mean, we are a long, long way from that. I think you could pick up some kernel of information that says, oh yes, Britain's on that path, but China is broadly considered an anomaly to the rule, and for good reason. It doesn't obey the same implicit laws, economic laws, political laws, social laws that other countries do and have throughout history. And so this rating system may well be implemented on some level in countries in the future because, as me and Max point out, it's actually quite convenient and it does quite effectively reward good behaviour. But the likelihood of Western countries or countries with firm democracies implementing it in the future that's not happening. Like that is sky blue thinking, blue sky thinking even. So I think you're singling China out as an anomaly and saying this is a thing and this is going to happen. This hell's democracy collapsing in the future. And I think no, I think it's very easy and I think it's quite important to rank China as being outside of normal conventions about how countries behave and act.
And with that, we should start to wrap it up. because this episode has gotten very long and very off topic.
Yes.
So what are people's final points? Will?
Final point would be that...
Hold on a second. No, you're not hosting. Stay out of it. You're compensating.
Hosting now.
You're compensating for the fact you've not said anything intelligent all episode. Right. Max, do you think democracy is dying or that there are factors in the world that are going to contribute to democracy declining?
Not in the long run. I think in the short run, there are definitely, you know, certain things that are happening, certain trends that are happening, which aren't good for the democratic process. However, I just don't think it as a concept will be able to just decay and die without some massive event occurring, which we cannot predict at the moment.
So it goes into some period of stagnation rather than death.
Yeah, yeah. And it will increase, you know, it will bounce back eventually.
It would have been nice if you said that at some point in the last hour or so.
Said at the start, yeah.
Will?
I personally think that democracy has the potential to carry on to the future, but I think the odds are somewhat stacked against it.
Okay.
And I would be surprised if in 50 years' time we were still as democratic across the world generally as we are today.
Okay.
I'm still hopeful for democracy. I think that once you become a democracy and like a good democracy, you're probably going to stay one. But that is potentially me just wishfully wanting that to be the way, because dictatorships scare me.
Well, yeah.
Mm.
Good. Well, we didn't actually answer the question this time. No one's opinion was changed.
Has anyone's opinion really changed?
Well, you decide that Corbyn's good now, so obviously yes. So thank you very much for listening. If you actually want to find out about the death of democracy, there are some good books and things that you can buy, I'm sure. But yeah, don't look to us to provide the answers.
We're free though, so yeah.
Yeah, we are. Maybe we should open a premium channel.
We have to pay people to listen.
Yeah, we could even do research for that one. Okay, well, thank you very much for listening. If you want to get in touch, do check us out on Instagram at podcastpoorly. And if you want to email us, then poorlyinformeddiscussion@gmail.com. Any last words?
Nope.
No.
Right. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.